This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 12th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, the relationship between the US and Russia gets even icier, if possible, over Russian aid flights to Syria.
We can say what we like about Barack Obama, and isn't he popular amongst the Gardenista readers here in Europe, but Putin's playing a blinder. He keeps winning this PR game over and over and over and over again.
We are also in Istanbul, where the head of the pro-Kurdish opposition party accuses the ruling AKP party for pushing Turkey toward civil war.
This society is being very quickly segmented according to very ideological lines of nationality, how one stands in relation to the Kurds, ethnicity, and also whether one believes that the AK party should be in power, a coalition should be in power, and that is really stoking up tensions here in this country.
We will also ask who loses and who wins as Donald Trump's bandwagon rolls bewilderingly on, and we are in Japan, where signs of life have been returning to a town made desolate by the Fukushima disaster. Plus, we will hear how the legacy of Australian politicians has been changed by their depiction on the silver screen. All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Markus Hippi. We start today's program in Japan, where the first of around 7,000 people evacuated from the town of Naraha after the Fukushima disaster were being allowed to return earlier this week. It's the first town among seven municipalities to have their contamination orders lifted, although there are concerns that the town, in which some houses are falling down and wild boar now roam at night, it's not yet ready for re-inhabitation. On Monday's edition of The Globalist, Monocle's Tyke Enright spoke to Asby Brown, researcher at Safecast, a Tokyo-based organization that maps radiation levels.
I would say that for people outside of the Fukushima area, people are not really paying that much attention to this issue anymore, and it's really in itself a bit of a problem. But for people in Fukushima who are watching very closely for what this sort of thing will mean for their livelihood and for their future, of course, people are very concerned, and there have been quite a lot of expressions of concern that the process is being rushed.
It must be quite a bittersweet moment, I suppose, for the town's former inhabitants. Some will be eager to return, some will perhaps have bad memories that they won't want to go back to. Just how many are actually going back? And in terms of the physical infrastructure of the town, what are they going to find when they go back?
Well, I would say that it's been fairly consistent, and actually Naraha is not really technically the first town that was evacuated to be reopened. It is the first town where nearly the entire population evacuated, however, that is being reopened. And in previous cases, as early as last year, the figures were somewhere around 10% expressing the desire at the beginning or actually taking the steps, but certainly less than half seem to be willing to move back. And this is primarily the case of people voting with their feet, that many of them have made lives elsewhere, and because of the concerns of their businesses and schools, and not to mention the radiation, many people find lots of reasons not to rush back.
Your organization obviously is one which monitors radiation levels. What has happened in Naraha? Is it safe to go back, particularly when you consider there won't be any local hospital open until February?
That's right. These other infrastructure issues, including schools, are definitely an important factor in influencing people's decisions to stay away. But what we've seen in Naraha, and again, we've been monitoring radiation in the area and mapping it since 2011, shortly after the disaster. It's a kind of unusual case where it's a pocket. Essentially, the residential areas are in a sort of pocket of radiation that is almost normal, in fact. It is actually not a higher external dose than you would get in most of Hong Kong or places like central France, where there is lots of granite that's causing natural radiation. But it's sort of surrounded on three sides by higher radiation areas. So in a way, it is possible that people could move back there and not really get a very high dose of radiation. But you have all of the other concerns. Of course, the lifestyle issues, the fact that people need to be careful what they're eating, a lot of stress issues associated with that. But it is an unusual case, and there are others like that up and down the coast where there are pockets of almost normalcy.
That was a highlight from Monday's edition of The Globalist, Tyke Enright speaking to Asby Brown, researcher at Safecast, a Tokyo-based organization that maps radiation levels. This is the recap on Monocle 24. Time now for a highlight from the Monocle Daily. Less than a week ago, Russia said it was premature to talk of its soldiers joining the fighting on the ground in Syria. But a spokesman in Moscow also said it was no secret Russia has been supplying the Assad regime with equipment. It's also no secret the United States is increasingly unhappy about it. Secretary of State John Kerry has phoned his counterpart in Moscow over reports Russian troops are preparing a much bigger intervention in Syria's civil war. On Monday, it emerged the US had asked Greece to ban Russian aid flights to Syria from its airspace. Greek officials said the request was being examined, but sources in Moscow claimed it had already been rejected. What's behind this rise in tension and where might it lead? Monocle's Paul Osborne and Ted Gravitz discussed that with James Boyce, an expert on US foreign policy and the author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy.
There's no doubt about it that a series of materials have been delivered into Syria by Russia to aid the Assad regime. And the United States is obviously concerned about this. How concerned? Well, obviously not concerned enough that it hasn't left a massive void in this part of the world for Russian aid to flow into. But one thing that's worth considering here, I think, are two elements. First of all, is that Greece, of course, is a member of NATO and therefore an ally with the United States and shouldn't be necessarily getting into bed with Russia too much. But one thing that's bizarre about this is, I don't know if anybody's actually looked at a map to see where Greece is in relation to Syria. Looking at this. Now, if we were talking about Turkey,
you don't have to fly over Greece.
If we were sitting here talking about Turkey and the fact that the Turkish government had been requested to deny airspace, that makes all kinds of sense because Turkey, for anybody who isn't familiar with this, is to the exact north of Syria. Iraq is to the east, and to the west you have the Mediterranean. Greece is across the Mediterranean Sea. This is a bit like asking the Republic of Ireland not to allow overflights into France, it seems to me. So what's fascinating about this story is that it all seems to be emanating out of Moscow, some elements out of Athens, but very little out of the Pentagon or the White House at this point. So I wonder if there's a degree of misinformation coming out at this point.
Okay. Do you think there's also a sort of struggle for influence in here as well?
Yeah, very much so. There's no doubt about it. I think for the last 18 months, 2 years, I've had the good pleasure of talking with you guys and your colleagues here at Monocle about, you know, how it is that world leaders are playing the overall big picture game. And I keep saying, look, you know, we can say what we like about Barack Obama, and isn't he popular amongst the Gardenista readers here in Europe, but Putin's playing a blinder. He keeps winning this PR game over and over and over and over again. The United States, you know, whatever one makes of the administration in Washington, appears to be quite happy to leave a political void here in both in the Middle East and in this part of the world, effectively. And guess what? Vladimir Putin is moving on in. And there's no doubt about it, I think, that by denying the move beyond his famous red line into Syria, you know, we're seeing a massive movement with peoples with regard to the immigration issues. And now, of course, Putin's moving in there to defend his ally, Mr. Assad.
What can the US offer to Greece? You say Greece is a member of NATO, and so it shouldn't really be helping out the Russians at all. But then again, Greece is in need of friends with deep pockets at the moment. What does the US do to persuade the Greeks to do as it asks?
Well, here's the great irony. You know, I started off talking about geography. Let's talk about history. If you think about why it is that the United States was in Europe after the Second World War, you know, I need to remind people of the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine. The Truman Doctrine that Harry Truman initiated came about because the British could no longer afford to defend Italy and Greece from guess whom? The Soviet threat, the communist threat moving in and infiltrating Greece and Italy after the Second World War. So now we have a bizarre situation whereby the Americans appear to be moving out of their sphere of influence. We all know about Obama's pivot to the Pacific. The Greeks are in desperate need of support, both in terms of policy, economics, and political and economic reinforcement. They don't seem to be getting it from the West. So surprise, surprise, they're looking anywhere else. And Vladimir Putin, I think, is stepping up to the plate at this point.
James Boyce, a US foreign policy expert there, speaking to Monocle's Ted Kravitz and Paul Osborne on Monday's edition of the Monocle Daily. You can download the whole show as a podcast at monocle.com, iTunes or SoundCloud. You are listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Now for a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House, where the focus was squarely upon US politics. If the Republican presidential contest has taught us anything, it is that tens of millions of people are at least comfortable with the idea of the power of life and death over all humankind being bestowed upon Donald Trump. As the Trump bandwagon rolls bewilderingly on, America's political establishment is scrambling to assess the implications, who loses, who benefits. In this snippet, Monocle's Andrew Müller discusses the political circus with Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Martin Sundbu, economics lead writer at the Financial Times.
It has been explained by what they call the narrative arc of his life. That is to say, quite quintessentially, rags to barefoot boy.
It is in many respects admirable. No
yeah,
getting
indeed,
around that.
Indeed. And so he's also an evangelical Christian, which...
The Seventh-day Adventist, specifically.
Okay, thank you. Footnote there. Which will tie in an awful lot of people. There's an awful lot of white Middle Westerners, white Southerners who like him, and no one's going to claim that they're dead keen on him because he's black. But it's funny, if you shut your eyes and you hear the accent and the neurosurgeon and the evangelical and so forth and so on, he's indistinguishable, if you see what I mean.
Indeed so.
So, and that also probably makes it a bit easier for people to support him. He's a nice man. He just has some very strange ideas. He has a wonderful life story. He's a brilliant man, as you say. He looks like a caring, sharing sort until he says some of the things he says.
Martin, are we looking at, this is my own pet theory, that this is basically an echo of the Trump phenomenon. It's the same thing. It's the batty fringes of the party throwing a massive tantrum before they finally realize they have to find somebody relatively presentable they can put to the American people. Is that what's going on here?
I was going to point that out. There are some very interesting similarities between Carson and Trump. Not always true similarities, but they're both seen as being self-made men in the Carson. For Ben Carson, that's true. For Trump, it's not. Of course, he was.
he had a bit of
help at the beginning, but they're both seen as both anti-establishment candidates that they are. But I think they're both perceived as having a life story that rather relieves a certain type of conservative from thinking that the social structure and how the economic game is rigged and so on actually affects your life chances. The rags-to-riches story, the bootstrap-your-way-up story.
You can look at Ben Carson and say there's no structural racism in this country because he made it by working hard and being clever.
Exactly, and one of the messages he gives, of course, is that we shouldn't look too much at race, right?
One thing one has to remember here, I think, that if you've got 25% for Trump and 14% for Carson, or whatever he is now, in fact, he's moved up in a few notches, some of them. That makes an awful huge fringe.
Monocle's Andrew Müller there with Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Martin Sundbu, economics lead writer at the Financial Times. That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House. You are listening to The Recap, Monocle's Best Of program, and we continue with more highlights after this break. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Let's head to Australia now, where politicians were debating earlier this week on whether to launch bombing raids on Islamic State targets in Syria. The involvement of Australia in the region's conflict has so far been restricted to around 300 troops in Iraq and supporting air forces currently engaged in neighbouring Syria. But on Tuesday, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop and Defence Defence Minister Kevin Andrews were said to be behind increasing the mission. The decision came amid wider debate in Australia over how many refugees the nation should accept from the war-torn nation. On Wednesday's Globalist, Georgina Godwin spoke to Aaron Young, Melbourne Bureau Chief for Sky News, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor for the London Evening Standard.
We've seen both the Labor Party, which is the opposition here, as well as the government, finally come to an agreement on this. There's been a two-pronged approach, as you've mentioned. First, there's been the fact that the United States has asked Australia to get involved to extend the airstrike operations to Islamic State targets in Syria. But then on top of that, we've seen the refugee crisis over the past few weeks. And because of that, there's been a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister from the opposition, as well as the Greens, essentially saying if we want to get involved in the airstrikes, we do need to have some responsibility and, of course, do something about these refugees. So today it was a joint announcement, as you mentioned, from the Prime Minister as well as the Defence Minister and the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, announcing that Australia would take 12,000 of these Syrian refugees. That is on top of Australia's general refugee intake. At first, we were looking a couple of days ago when the Prime Minister made the announcement that any extra refugees from Syria would in fact mean that other people would lose their spots from other countries. That didn't go down too well. And in fact, the Greens leader here in Australia, Senator Richard Di Natale, held a news conference a short time ago. He was essentially saying to the hundreds of thousands of Australians who have been pushing the government, getting in contact with their local MPs, that they've done a great job of essentially making the government come to this decision.
Well, let's turn to Robert now in the studio. Robert, there have been allegations in Australia that ministers are trying to out-compassion each other. Is that something we're seeing in Europe too, or is that just a very cynical way of looking at it?
There are very different takes on this. The generosity of Germany is quite striking, preparing for 800,000, saying they could take 500,000 for several years more. That is possibly something to do with the Merkel coalition's perception of the demographic deficit, which nobody is talking about, the fact that the productive population of Germany is going down dramatically. The other thing is that the stinginess of the British is fascinating here. Cameron is very worried by the deficit in educational and orphan care facilities, because there's not enough foster care to go around for British orphans anyway. And this is the sort of thing that's featuring. There's a lot of nitpicking there, but there's a fascinating thing regarding the Australian and the British position, is that they're trying to outbid each other. But this is such a colossal problem, and it looks as if it's going to go on for years, 2 or 3 years more at least, with the outflow from Syria. And now we're getting one from Iraq, by the way, which is going to be the next talking point, that it can only be done on a pan-European basis.
Aaron Young, Melbourne Bureau Chief for Sky News, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor for the London Evening Standard, there speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin on Wednesday's edition of The Globalist. You are listening to the recap on Monocle 24. On Thursday's edition of The Briefing, we discussed the current pre-election tensions in Turkey. Selahattin Demirtas, the leader of Turkey's main pro-Kurdish party, HDP, warned on Thursday that the country was being dragged into a civil war after a wave of attacks on its offices by nationalists outraged by Kurdish rebel violence. No one had been killed, but Demirtas said his supporters were facing a campaign of lynching. This is what Georgina Godwin discussed with our Istanbul bureau chief, Chris Lord.
It's worth us mentioning here that in the September issue of Monocle, there's an interview with Selahattin Demirtas, the co-leader of the HDP, in which we specifically asked him the question of, you know, what is the relationship between the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, and your HDP party? And he explicitly says in that interview, there is no organic relationship between the two of us. They can't speak for us, and we cannot speak for them. Now, ever since, as you mentioned, that vote in June, when his party got 14% of the vote, and they entered Ankara and took seats in parliament, ever since that moment, really, the electorate has been very closely watching how Selahattin Demirtas responds to the resumption of conflict between the PKK and the Turkish government. A lot of people here are very, very suspicious of the relationship between those two entities, essentially. A lot of people say this is essentially just the legitimate face of a PKK separatist agenda, whereas his supporters say there is no organic relationship, this is not the backbone of the party, there's not a separatist agenda, this is a Turkish party who wants to you know, increase the standing of Kurds in Turkish society. So that the whole question really has gravitated and been absolutely top of the agenda for a lot of people ever since the HDP entered parliament in June.
Now, he's talking about this campaign of lynching. What exactly has been happening to members of his party?
Well, he's got some extraordinary figures. I mean, he says there's been 400 attacks on HDP party buildings in the last 2 days. I mean, that was his quote that came out this morning. I mean, we do know absolutely for a start that the Ankara HDP headquarters, which was where Monocle conducted the interview for the September issue, that that has been completely torched. And, you know, photographs have come out from there. Extremely shocking. I mean, I think that the term lynch is an extremely strong language to use here. Mm. But Demirtas has said something that I did think is very interesting this morning. He said he's even questioned whether a vote, which is obviously Turkey has to now go back to the polls because there's been an undecided election since June. Demirtas has said this morning, can a vote even go ahead given the current circumstances in Turkey? The sense that, you know, there's a resumption of conflict with the PKK, certain zones of the country are actually under curfew and under semi-military control at the moment. He's saying, is it even right to stage an election at the moment? So, as I say, I think the term lynching is an extremely strong and loaded term. However, no one can deny that this society is being very quickly segmented according to very ideological lines of nationality, how one stands in relation to the Kurds, ethnicity, and also whether one believes that the AK Party should be in power, whether one believes that a coalition should be in power, and that is really stoking up tensions here in this country.
Monocle's Istanbul Bureau Chief Christopher Lord there speaking to our Georgina Godwin on Thursday's edition of The Briefing. You can download the whole show as a podcast from Monocle's website, iTunes or SoundCloud. All this week here on Monocle 24, we examined how fictional portrayals of political leaders on screen can alter the way in which we remember them. From HBO's upcoming look at Lyndon B. Johnson's time in the White House to Meryl Streep's spin on Margaret Thatcher. We concluded the series on Friday by turning our attention back to 1975 as Australia faced its worst ever constitutional crisis. Gough Whitlam is fondly remembered by many Australians today, but that wasn't always the case. And as Ben Ryland explains, a landmark 1983 television series played a key role in helping Australians make sense of the bizarre political quake that rippled from the nation's capital from the 1970s and well into the future.
For most Australians today, there's never been a more tumultuous time in politics than the years of Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. When Prime Minister Rudd was replaced by Prime Minister Gillard, only to be replaced again by Prime Minister Rudd, Australians, already a cynical bunch, became even more cynical, while international observers were just confused. However, while Canberra indeed descended into an excruciating circus during those years, it was far from the worst political crisis the country has ever faced. In 1975, an event occurred that became so engraved in the collective mind of Australia, it would become known as simply the dismissal. Gough Whitlam had been elected in 1972 after a wonderfully successful election campaign based around the simple slogan, "It's time," a tactic not unlike the one used by Kevin Rudd decades later. But by 1975, the government found itself in a deadlock against the federal opposition over financing for appropriation bills. Prime Minister Whitlam had intended to call a half-Senate election, designed to break the political deadlock. The matter had become an unfortunate growth in the government's ability to function, but Whitlam sensed no threat to his position. After all, the details were rather dull, and it was far from the kind of juicy scandal one might expect could threaten a recently elected government. On the 11th of November 1975, Gough Whitlam visited the office of the Governor-General, the Queen's representative in Australia, to call for a Senate election. Instead, Governor-General John Kerr did what no one before and no one after him has done. He dismissed the federal government of Australia.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
Opposition leader Malcolm Fraser was installed as caretaker Prime Minister as protests erupted around the country. The House Speaker even wrote to the Queen, asking her to reinstate the Whitlam government. The reply from her private secretary said that while she was watching the events with interest, it would be improper for her to intervene. Australia's worst constitutional crisis was always destined to be dramatised. In 1983, the filmmaking greats George Miller and Philip Noyce partly penned and jointly directed a miniseries for television. That year was also a major turning point for the nation, with the election of Labor Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who would go on to win three more elections and become the party's most successful leader.
Four split them to the wall.
It will be a battle of political will, unprecedented in its magnitude, exemplified by heated political clashes, allegations, counter-allegations, and an ever-increasing air of scandal.
Big sign, you stupid. I do not like finding out information about my government from the opposition.
Premiering right after the 1983 election, The Dismissal masterfully dramatised the events of the 1975 crisis. But rather than altering the manner in which people viewed that point in history, it really served as a kind of cultural cement, locking the time away into history and ensuring future generations, regardless of their birth date, would know all about what happened in 1975. That's perhaps partly due to the real Gough Whitlam. Despite being Prime Minister for a relatively short period, the years following his time in the capital would see him become a formidable presence. His conservative nemesis, Malcolm Fraser, went on to win the subsequent election, but years later, the pair would come to agree on many issues.
That will give us a president who's bipartisan and above politics.
Malcolm, it's time.
It is.
When Australia voted on whether to cut its Commonwealth ties to the United Kingdom in 1999, the unlikely duo emerged as allies in the campaign to vote yes. Without doubt, one of the greatest performers Australian politics has ever seen, Whitlam's death last year prompted many to revisit his legacy. But instead of digging up the famous dismissal, many modern commentators remembered the time he ended Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War, abolishing conscription and promptly releasing all of those who had objected from prison. They recalled the time he decided that the nation's anthem, God Save the Queen, was actually God Awful, and so had it officially changed to Advance Australia Fair. And perhaps his most influential change? The removal of university fees is the one more often referenced. There are few influential Australians today who didn't benefit from Whitlam's free education. More books have been written about Whitlam than any other Australian Prime Minister. One of his biographers, Jenny Hocking, remarked that despite being viewed quite negatively for at least a decade following the dismissal, public perceptions of Whitlam, the man and the government, have since evolved quite beyond the famous rallying cry of defeat on the steps of Old Parliament. The TV depiction of Gough Whitlam's fall is one of those rare masterpieces in Australian media that's still looked upon as a key milestone in the nation's history. Rather than shape our perceptions, it's become a signpost guiding us through our past and reminding us of where to avoid in the future, even if some continue to miss the point. And while a future adaptation is all but inevitable, no portrayal is likely to ever eclipse the man himself.
That was Ben Ryland there looking back on the dismissal and the aftermath that shaped the legacy of Gough Whitlam. That was the final part of our series profiling political depictions on screen. You can hear the whole week's worth of material by heading to our website, monocle.com. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. This show was edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Markus Hippi, thank you for listening and goodbye.